Veterans Radio is dedicated to all the men and women who have served or are currently serving in the armed forces of the United States of America.
From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Dale Thronberry.
Back here on Veterans Radio, and good morning from Ann Arbor, Michigan, from our home studios, WDEO in Ann Arbor, and on the internet around the world at veteransradio.net. We have kind of an unusual opening this morning because I wanted to talk to you about what's coming up in a little bit, and that's going to be our guest today, is Owen West, and Owen is the author of a great book called The Snake Eaters. That's a nice, friendly title. But it's about the role of the American advisors in Iraq, and I think you really need to stay tuned for this story. I don't think any of us knew exactly what the American advisors were doing over there or what they're doing in Afghanistan, and this is going to be a great way for you to find out, because Owen not only was over there as an advisor, but he was talking to everybody in this particular organization with the Iraqi army, and it's a fascinating story, and we're going to get to that after our first break. But right now, I want to introduce the world to one of the first sponsors of Veterans Radio. Back in 2003, when Bob Gould and I came up with the idea for Veterans Radio, I approached my good friend Ray Schrader. Ray and I went to flight school together and ended up going to Vietnam together, although not in the same units, and we've been able to maintain a pretty good friendship, I'd say, for over almost 40 years now. I don't know how we got to be that old. But anyhow, and this weekend I'm very fortunate to have Ray as a guest in studio with us, and world... welcome, Ray Schrader. Welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Dale. Same to you.
See how calm he is? He was always the calm one in the whole mess. I'm going to ask you a question, and I'm not going to put you on a spot with it, but I wanted to let the world know a little bit about how we met, and if you could tell it, kind of review that thing, if we can remember that long ago.
Well, we were in Fort Walters, Texas, in what was called Snowbirds for 2 weeks.
Because the snowbirds can't fly, so that's why
we
call that.
And I had the top bunk, and you had the bottom bunk, and we were friends ever since.
The way I remember it is that I came into the barracks late in the evening, or when I finally arrived, and the TAC officer, said, "You're going to sleep in there," and and threw all my bunks and stuff. And this guy leans over the top bunk and says something to the effect of, "What the heck is going on here? Who are you?" And he has this really great New Jersey accent, and I just kind of turned around and gave him the same thing with a Jersey accent. We both said, "Well, where are you from?" And he said, "I'm from Point Pleasant." "What do you mean Point Pleasant?" "My grandfather's from Point Pleasant, and I grew up at the shore also." So that was the beginning of what I like to say is a beautiful friendship. Ray has been an integral part of my life and my wife's life. We've known each other, as I said, for 40 years now. What got you into flying helicopters?
I was drafted, and I was just lucky.
Well, you went to Fort Dix, you said before, and then you ended up going to Fort Polk for AIT.
I went to Fort Polk on my way to Vietnam as an infantryman.
Right, and, for advanced training, right? Or what did you do there?
I had AIT. I was going to Vietnam with a machine gun.
Okay.
Method of operation. And I was able to convince somebody that I should go to flight school. And unexpectedly, they sent me back for 2 weeks leave, and I went down to Texas.
Beautiful Fort Walters.
Yes.
Out there, right by Miserable Wells, west of Dallas-Fort Worth. I like to tell the story of being out there, where the highlight of the places that we could visit was a place called Possum Kingdom Lake. So you can imagine the excitement of that, and that was the first time I'd ever seen a tarantula, also was in Texas.
Well, there were some other names for mineral wells also.
Well, Miserable Wells and some other ones.
Yeah.
And we had the opportunity. What did we fly there? What did we learn how to fly there anyway?
Hiller, OH-23s.
The OH-23 was built in probably the 50s. I mean, they were, I don't know, they probably were in Korea, I'm guessing.
The helicopter I had was about 5 years younger than I was at the time.
That's good. These Hillers, where they had a bench seat in it, and the two student pilots would cram us in, and instructor was usually, I think, it's sitting in the left seat. I can't remember now.
Left seat.
Yeah. And then the student pilot was in the middle, and then the rider or the
right.
was on the outside. And while we were in Texas, Ray and I had to go on these long-distance flights for navigation to learn how to navigate. And how did we do on that?
We did pretty well till we got lost. And I think it was your idea that we land at a gas station for directions, since we didn't know how to read maps very well at the time.
I thought it was an excellent idea. Plus, you could get a cold Coke while you were down there.
That's right.
I think you were the one that came up with the idea that maybe our heads wouldn't explode when we took our helmets off.
With our feet out the door, yes. We tried some adventurous things as we progressed.
I think we have a I don't have a picture of this. For those of you that are watching on a webcast, those are OH-23s and their revetments in Vietnam. He's flying aircraft in Vietnam that are, you know, 20 years old or so forth. And what was the maximum speed of the OH-23?
About 60 knots downhill.
And why were you flying those in Vietnam?
Because the unit that I was in ran out of loaches, which were turbines, and the government sent us these Hillers to replace them. And I happened to have had experience in it, so I became an instructor in Vietnam in an OH-23, which was archaic.
Well, to say the least. And where were you stationed in Vietnam?
Just north of Pleiku on Artillery Hill.
Okay, and Pleiku was up in Tu Cor,
Central Highlands.
Okay. And Ray and I were able to get together in Vietnam because every once in a while he had to go to Saigon to get parts. And
right.
since I was stationed in 195th was stationed in Long Binh, he would muck up traffic at the airfield by trying to land this OH-23 when everything else was flying around, and we would come in and visit just because he wanted to fly, you know, wanted to ride on a Huey is what he really wanted to do.
I remember you were quite embarrassed the first time I landed there with a 23 when you realized who it was. It was it really was an old aircraft.
They were old. And so what were you, other than trying to avoid bullets in a very slow helicopter, what was your job up in Pleiku?
We were the 52nd Artillery Group, which we supported the artillery that was out in LZs and protecting the infantrymen. And we resupplied them, did convoy cover, adjusted fire for artillery.
Mm-hmm.
It was we did about everything, from having a small minigun on our aircraft to M60s on the 23s, and very versatile.
Well, they put M60s on your 23?
Correct, yeah, on the left skid.
When you were flying the 23, were you flying by yourself, or did you have somebody with you?
No, we were by ourselves.
And then you had to aim and fire that thing. I mean, you had to turn the helicopter and aim it.
Well, yeah, we used the paddles or controls, right. And it just shot straight ahead, and whichever way you pointed, it was where the bullets would go.
You eventually got some loaches back, didn't you?
Yes.
And what were the missions with the loaches?
Same thing.
Same thing?
Yeah.
But you had miniguns on that.
Correct.
That would be more fun.
Part of the time for convoy cover and such, but we resupplied artillery in very tight quarters, so the loaches, being a very small ship, was a big advantage, where the aircraft you flew would create too much chaos when you came into a lot of these little bases where mm-hmm. we could go in very undetected and smaller supply capacity, but it worked.
It's true. Normally when we would land someplace with a Huey, we blew stuff down.
Correct.
Okay, so you again. So, all right, so we, obviously you survived Vietnam, and where did you go after that?
Germany.
Germany?
Yeah. Well, I was on the...
Yeah, I put in for Germany, too, but I didn't get to go to Germany. I got to go back to Fort Rucker.
I enjoyed Europe.
What did you do? What did you do over there?
I was in an air cav unit, and I flew UEs in Europe as you had in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And it was did a lot of advanced tactics and tank warfare. Air Force was involved a lot of experimental flying in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Well, you had to protect that pass, whatever that was called, in Germany, didn't you? Or you flew across the border between East and West Germany?
For a while, we patrolled the border. We used to wave to the, they weren't Russians, but the East German guards.
Mm-hmm.
We were within a couple hundred feet of them.
Well, you know, and you continued flying after you got out of the service, too, didn't you, for a while?
And I flew for 30 years.
And what else? What kind of flying did you do?
I flew for the National Guard in New Jersey and then for the New Jersey Forest Fire Service, which was very interesting. Water buckets under UEs and fixed wing.
Fixed wing, too?
Yeah, fixed wing, too.
Okay. Yeah, so Ray would fly around these helicopters that you see on the news now with all the fires out in the western United States with a big giant bucket of water under there.
That is correct.
And then you would time it, theoretically, where the water would land on the fire.
If it didn't land on somebody else, yes. It was never hurt anybody, but it was quite a...
How many gallons of water are in those?
250.
Oh, okay.
On the ships we flew, there were much larger buckets out west on bigger aircraft.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned earlier in the program that Ray was one of our very, very first sponsors on Veterans Radio and was one of the guys that helped us get going. And I wanted to thank you on the air, and I want to thank your entire staff because I know that some of them are listening out there in New Jersey. So tell us a little bit about Schrader Yachts. I'll give you this free commercial time.
Well, we're a boat dealer. We sell Chris Crafts and Parker fishing boats and Island Packet sailboats. Out of mid-New Jersey, coastal cruising, big fishing area. And we've been dealers for some of those companies for over 25 years. It's been an interesting occupation. I've had a good time with it.
Well, you've always liked boats.
Yes, I
were a boat person.
Grew up in boats.
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, you know, Ray grew up in Point Pleasant, New Jersey, and my grandfather lived right around the corner from his house, and I never knew it, of course. Although if you see Ray, you would know, you would never forget him. How tall are you?
6'2".
No, you're not. Come on. I'm 6'2". Bump it up to where you were.
I've shrunk.
Oh, well, yeah. Well, we've all done that a little bit, unfortunately. And I for those of you, unfortunately, people are not, a lot of you are not watching the webcast, but we do have a picture of Ray compacted into an OH, you know, a loach when we had the privilege of going to the reunion in Washington, D.C., a couple of years ago for the Vietnam Helicopter Pilots Association, and I thought that was a big hoot.
That was a great time. I really enjoyed it with you and with all the other veteran pilots that were there. It was very exciting.
You know, we were talking earlier. I've been fortunate. Ray's been staying here for a couple of days, and we were talking about, you know, going into that reunion and not knowing, you know, because we hadn't seen these people in, you know, 35, 40 years.
That's right.
And suddenly you just saw somebody and you go, oh, it's so-and-so. And they look, oh, hey, how you know? And everybody knew everybody, even though many of us, our body shapes had changed dramatically.
That's true.
it was a great time to meet with them. Ray, thank you so very much for being on Veteran Radio. I want to say hi again to all the crew out there at Schrader Yacht Sales. They've been very supportive. Ray's been supportive. We need your support out there, so pay attention. Go to our website. We need some more, you know. We need help to keep. We want to make sure we stay on the air.
Thank you for having me on, Dale.
Okay, we'll be right back. Coming up after our first break with a couple of commercials that we're going to run, we'll be back with Owen West, the Snake Eaters. Schrader Yacht Sales, the East Coast's finest dealer of Chris Craft, Island Packet Yachts, Packet Craft, Parker Fishing Boats, and Nautic Star Boats. Schrader Yachts is located at the top of Barnegat Bay in Point Pleasant, New Jersey. Our good friend Ray Schrader provides you, the customer, with over 30 years' experience in boat sales, sail and power boats, both new and used. Schrader Yacht Sales offers a full-service storage facility and a reliable crew responsible for all of your boating needs. Specialists in electronics, they can accommodate your needs for radar, autopilot, air conditioning, GPS, heat, and communications. Give Ray a call at 732-899-8010. That's 732-899-8010, or go to SchraderYachts.com. That's SchraderYachts.com. Oh, by the way, tell Ray you heard about him on Veterans Radio, and he will personally deliver your new boat from Schrader Yachts anywhere there's water. Schrader Yachts, ready to serve all of your boating needs.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill. The benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, and joining me on the program right now is author Owen West. And Owen is a former Marine major who served two combat tours in Iraq, one as an advisor to the Snake Eaters. We'll find out what that means in a little bit. He's a graduate of Harvard College and Stanford Business School. He's the author of two other novels, including Sharkman 6. His work has appeared in Men's Journal, Playboy, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, and numerous other publications. And he is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and is a director of the Marine Corps Scholarship Foundation. See, we got all kinds of things. And his writings can be found at www.westwrite.com. And Owen West, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thanks for having me this morning.
I was really fascinated by this book, and I want to remind our audience out there, if you have any questions that you'd like to ask Owen as we go along or to add to the story, just give us a call here on Veterans Radio at 877-573-7825. It's 877-573-7825. Thank you very much. Owen, what caused you to write this story?
Well, inspiration's tricky to pinpoint, but I really needed to get the story of the U.S. advisor out, especially because the advisor has become the centerpiece of U.S. strategy in Iraq eventually once we came to that conclusion, and now in Afghanistan. But so few people understand what it is advisors are supposed to do, including the president and most advisors. So
right.
I think what we need is doctrine.
You need what?
We need doctrine.
Doctrine, okay.
The largest advisor effort that we undertook was in your war in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
But because of that war, I believe that advisors became stigmatized or a symbol of mission creep. And as a result, while at the height of the war we had 12,000 advisors in Vietnam, the entire thing was dismantled after that war. And that cost us dearly in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Right. Well, we can discuss the causes of the war in Iraq and, are getting involved and so forth. But it seemed like, as you mentioned, the lack of a doctrine or a lack of a plan of everybody always eventually wanted to turn over control of the war to the Iraqis, but nobody seemed to know how they were going to do it. And
that's exactly right. Yeah, I think the conclusion that we've reached after a decade of war is that United States troops can't go into small villages and reveal the insurgents or discover the insurgents hiding among a complicit population.
Mm-hmm.
Only local troops can do that. We've reached this conclusion now, but, because we had given up on advisors after Vietnam, we had no trained advisors and we had no plan, so we had several what those in the government call lost years in both Iraq and Afghanistan as we tried to figure out what it is advisors are supposed to do. And I'm not convinced the government or even the generals understand it still.
Well, in your book, and again, as I mentioned earlier, it's a fascinating book called The Snake Eaters. And it's about an unlikely band of brothers in a battle for the soul of Iraq. And what I liked about it is that, I mean, it's semi-autobiographical, but you don't get into the book really until the last 50 to 75 pages. You're kind of giving us the history of this group of Iraqi soldiers and the Americans that were there as advisors. Can you tell me a little bit about the Iraqi troops that you were working with?
Sure. The Iraqi troops who were part of the Snake Eaters, that was a nickname they eventually gave themselves when they operated alongside Marine units, who all had these cool nicknames, by the way. They were Saddam's special forces for the most part, and they had been promised, or so they said, because of the leaflet drops ahead of the invasion in 2003, that if they would just lay down their weapons and join the United States, they would still be employed and they'd be used to secure their own country. That's what they fully expected. When Ambassador Bremer disbanded the Iraqi army, they were stunned. I mean, there's you know, no more hated man among the Iraqi military, except for Saddam, than Ambassador Bremer, unfortunately. When we finally came to our senses and put out notices that, in fact, we did need former professional soldiers from Iraq's military to help us in this effort at taming the growing insurgency, these Snake Eaters were among the first to join. I mean, they kind of were like a fantasy football team. They were meeting in Baghdad waiting for us to come to our senses. So they assembled some of the best troops. The officer corps was a mix of Sunni and Shiite, but the Jundis, who are the enlisted soldiers, were almost all Shiite and mostly poor from Baghdad and South Iraq. So when this unit was trained and then sent into Anbar province, which was all Sunni, the local Sunnis hated the Iraqi military as much as they did the United States troops. So both the U.S. advisors and the Iraqis were forced to figure out a very complex insurgency on their own because, as I said, they had no training.
Well, the thing I found really fascinating, and of course I wasn't aware of it either, is that the first advisors really that started working with this Iraqi, the Snake Eaters, was a group of National Guard and reservists. They weren't even regular Army.
That's right. Actually, you know, preceding them in training, the very first advisor that the Iraqis remember was a 57-year-old Vietnam veteran who was so brave that he would ride in the back of these pickup trucks the Iraqis used into battle. No other American would do that. And that set the tone for future advisors. The Iraqis then began to expect that the first quality their advisors had to have was bravery.
Mm-hmm.
When the Iraqis were sent into Anbar province, many of them deserted because they didn't want to go fight there. And the advisors who were assigned to them were totally unprepared for their mission. As you mentioned, they were Army reservists. They included an electric guitarist, a plumber, a DEA agent was their team leader, a postal worker. They expected to go on a base, you know, where you have coffee shops and a fitness center and everything else.
Right.
And basically, and this is the same vision that the president is espousing now, and basically train the Iraqis in a secure environment. March them around, show them how to fire AK-47s, maybe take some videos of them doing jumping jacks or something and post it on the web. And instead they were put on this isolated outpost and were fighting for their lives on day one.
I found it fascinating that these men were, as you mentioned, were, you know, anticipated being back on a major base with all the conveniences of home, and they ended up being on a base that had none of the conveniences of a home, including the lack of sanitation, lack of food, lack of support, lack of supplies. And the Iraqis, unfortunately, sounded as if they didn't have any sort of support from Baghdad.
No, that's right. I mean, the advisors' role in Afghanistan and in Iraq is kind of threefold. But first is that the local forces expect you to supply them. You know, you have the money, so they want you to basically scrounge around and get them everything from generators to sheep. The second thing that they want you to do is tie their unit to U.S. firepower, artillery and air support, and to, more importantly, medevac support, so that if anyone's hurt on the battlefield, it's a U.S. flight that comes in immediately and saves the local troops' life. But beyond those two things, as these rookie advisors discovered, the most important thing the Iraqis wanted was to see a stalwart American under fire on the battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they really wanted combat leadership. For all the wars that the Iraqis had been in over the last three decades, and they fought a decade-long war with millions of casualties against Iran, they were still not very good fighters when the Americans showed up. Under fire, the Iraqis naturally flocked and mimicked what the American soldiers did. So for these reservists, you know, they were stunned to realize that, man, you know, advising is not training. Advising is when an insurgent takes you under fire, showing the Iraqis what to do and how to win individual firefights.
Mm-hmm.
And it took them a while to digest that.
Well, maybe you can explain a little bit to our audience about how the Iraqi army, even I guess even today, it sounds like, how they get their officer corps or how they're promoted.
Well, it's a patrimonial system under Saddam, and this is not uncommon. This is what goes on in Afghanistan. So in the United States, we still have this antiquated system where to be an officer, you have to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
In most other countries, to be an officer, you have to know somebody. You know, your education matters not, your fitness matters not. So in the Iraqi officer corps, as in Afghanistan, it was Sunnis and Baathists who were connected to Saddam, sometimes directly, by the way, to his extended family and tribe. And then you had wealthy Shia as well, a nice mix of kind of the richer Shia who had penetrated the professional ranks, lawyers and doctors, you know, sons who had decided to go into the military. But it was all selection, you know, and the promotion system was basically a bribery scheme where if you wanted to be promoted, every promotion had a fixed monetary cost.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really interesting because to try to get one of your Iraqi proteges promoted, you had to find $5,000 or $10,000, and then they could move up the ranks. In one case, the advisors wanted to get the battalion commander, who was a coward, the Iraqi battalion commander, relieved.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, advisors today lack the power to hire and fire, and this is one of my main criticisms of the current structure. This is what we face in Afghanistan. You read all the time about this intense corruption,
right,
that is preventing the locals from connecting with their own forces. And yet we have handed over so much authority to the locals, notwithstanding the fact, by the way, we've poured almost $1 trillion into Iraq and Afghanistan. In future conflicts, I believe we should retain the authority to populate the local ranks with those soldiers who are win their rank on merit, as
mm-hmm.
we do. So in this case, a bunch of the advisors managed to basically raise funds to get this cowardly battalion commander promoted out of the unit, which is a classic United States move in the United States as well, although we don't use it with money.
Right, yeah. You get kicked upstairs or transferred.
That's right.
Laterally.
Yeah, you get a medal or something else,
right,
and they kind of pat you on the back and get you out of the way.
I just found that fascinating. We've got about a minute to go until we take a break at the bottom of the hour. We're talking with Owen West, the author of Snake Eaters, about American advisors in Iraq. And I encourage you to give us a call if you have a question for Owen. The number is 877-573-7825, and we'll be happy to put you on the air and let you know, ask you a question about what's going on in Iraq and Afghanistan, because I don't think any of us had a clue, really, about what was going on. And I'm going to go to our break early here in a second. When we come back on the other side, I want to talk a little bit about the culture shock that not only you had, but what the American troops have. So we're going to go to a break right now at the bottom of the hour. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. First Lieutenant Jack Jacobs, although seriously wounded, made repeated trips across an open rice paddy, evacuating wounded and their weapons. Details after this.
As a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, joining IAVA.org really helps in the transition home. It's a network of OIF and OEF vets like me who've got your back here, just like we did over there. That means when you need help navigating the GI Bill, we've got your back. And when you're dealing with the transition home, we've got your back. Or when you just want someone to share stories with, we've got your back. Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org. We've got your back.
Brought to you by IAVA and the Ad Council.
Jacob served as an assistant battalion advisor in Kien Phong Province, Republic of Vietnam. The battalion was advancing when it came under intense heavy machine gun and mortar fire. Jacobs called for and directed airstrikes on the enemy positions. Due to the intensity of the enemy fire and heavy casualties to the command group, including the company commander, the attack stopped and the friendly troops became disorganized. Wounded by mortar fragments, Jacobs assumed command of the company, ordered a withdrawal from the exposed position, and established a defensive perimeter. Despite heavy bleeding from head wounds that impaired his vision, Jacobs returned under intense fire to evacuate a seriously wounded advisor to safety, where he administered life-saving first aid. He then returned through heavy automatic weapons fire to evacuate the wounded company commander. Jacobs made repeated trips across the fire-swept open rice paddies, evacuating wounded and their weapons. On three separate occasions, Jacobs drove off Viet Cong squads who were searching for Allied wounded and weapons, single-handedly killing three and wounding several others. His actions saved the lives of a U.S. advisor and 13 Allied soldiers. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
This is Dale Thronberry with Veterans Radio, and we want to encourage you to support Veterans Radio. If you like what you're listening to today and what you've listened to in the past, we need your support, so please send us your money, your checks, everything that you've got, First Child, whatever it happens to be out there. Well, we need the support to keep our programs going so that we can update all kinds of different things for you and get the type of stories that you want to hear. So send your donation to Veterans Radio, P.O. Box 3085, that's P.O. Box 3085, Ann Arbor, Michigan, 48106. That's Ann Arbor, Michigan, 48106, and thank you very much for listening. And we're back on Veterans Radio, and we're talking with Owen West, the author of The Snake Eaters, about the American advisors working with the Iraqi troops. And I'm not even going to try to pronounce the names of the towns out there. I was talking earlier with Ray about how we can say all of these things in Vietnam, but when it comes to saying some names of towns in Iraq and Afghanistan, it just doesn't work right. So where were you stationed in this second time through for you?
Well, that shows you how you assimilate with the local cultures, because I have difficulty with saying the towns that my dad served in Vietnam.
By the way, I should mention to our audience that Owen's father is Bing West, who has been on Veterans Radio, and he is the author of The Strongest Tribe and also the definitive instructional book about American advisors in Vietnam. So yeah, that's a plug for him.
I'll let him know. Thanks. This book takes place in Khalidiyah, Iraq, which is in the heart of the Sunni uprising in Anbar province. Your listeners have certainly heard of Fallujah, which was the the city where the largest single battle occurred of the war. And Ramadi, which was the soul of the Sunni insurgency. We used to call those commuters going back and forth between Fallujah and Ramadi the commuters from hell, because they would often come from Syria and move along what was called the rat line of the Euphrates, traveling back and forth with munitions, occasionally planting a mine or taking a sniper shot along the way. So the mix of folks in Khalidiyah was really a toxic cocktail. You had local guys who were just out to take a pot shot at you or dig in a mine. And then occasionally, just like you may have a drug cartel show up in San Diego or something, you could feel the townspeople change when the hardcore Al-Qaeda folks came in to stop over, because things got very quiet. But immediately after their departure, the mines were that much more catastrophic.
And this was this area was bordered by, was it called Michigan Avenue or Michigan something?
It was called Route Michigan,
Route Michigan.
Was the nickname that ran, I believe, given in the early part of a war by a group, an army unit that was mostly from Michigan. So they were able, like, you know, landing on the moon or something, or picking out a star to name this, and it sat in perpetuity as Route Michigan. But Michigan ran from Baghdad, the airport, all the way out to the Syrian border. And this was the road that had the definitively the most mines of the entire war.
Can you describe for our listeners just briefly about these mines and how they were able to plant them or undetected, and how we were able to find them?
Well, the detection rate, meaning the ability to find a mine before it exploded, was only about 50% throughout the war, or up until the Anbar Awakening, which maybe we'll get to. They range from very small kind of improvised explosives, which could be a can filled with nails and some plastique or gunpowder that someone might step on, like a pressure plate, as in a Vietnam-style anti-personnel mine, to three or four artillery shells wrapped up that were detonated by a cellular phone. They would put a base station or a phone, and that electronic signal would detonate the mine. That caused them to have a little bit of difficulty because the timing had to be right. So many of your listeners have seen the videos of a Humvee just making it past a giant explosion. Right. But the economics work like this. Al-Qaeda, who received money from controlling the fuel sales in our area, they received about $100,000 of black market sales each month. And they also, you know, unsurprisingly but irritatingly, received money from the United States indirectly, because we gave out so much money to these local contractors. Much of that money was then repatriated by the insurgency and used to blow up our own guys. They would pay it what was called a digger, which is just a local kid, $100. And they used to pay in $100 bills, which made it easy for us to figure out who was doing the digging, because, you know, occasionally you'd stop and frisk, you know, some local kid, and he'd have a crisp $100 bill on him. Then they would pay another kid at night to go run over and put in the mine. And then they'd pay a third guy, the electronics expert, and I use that term really loosely, just someone who wouldn't blow themselves up by connecting the wires. He would come in after that and tie together the wires. Now, why they had three different people do this job was actually fairly smart, because if you caught the first kid, who was often the digger, that was often the person you'd catch, because he'd just be out digging at some odd time right next to the road. He really didn't know who he was working for. And, you know, because of the soft, the intense restrictions on interrogation anyway, you really couldn't get much information out of him. So they were pretty well protected. If you killed an American, you were paid an additional $70 in our town. If you killed an Iraqi soldier, it was about the same, except for one Iraqi soldier we had, who was the toughest guy in the Iraqi battalion, named Major Muhammad, and his head was worth over $200.
What about these? We got a question, actually, from the off air about these daisy chain mines. Are you familiar with those?
The daisy chain's a pernicious trick, essentially. Our EOD, or Explosive Ordnance Disposal Units, are really good. These are the guys who are featured in the Hurt Locker. They can kind of detect a mine and go de-arm it very professionally. So what the insurgents began to do would be, as you mentioned, daisy chain, which means they would place one mine very obviously, and then maybe dig 20 meters away and place another mine, and then dig another 20 meters away and place another mine. And the goal was that the American forces or the Iraqi forces would come up and de-arm the first mine, but the insurgents would be able to set off the subsequent chain behind, where everyone might be staged watching the initial mine be de-armed.
Okay, gotcha.
Yep.
Gotcha. Okay. Let's get back into Anbar and talk about how these advisors were able to get their unit, these snake eaters, to fight in a more professional manner.
Well, advising is a really tricky job. You know, you need kind of the survivalist skills, almost like one of this the guy on Man versus Wild, because you don't have all the logistical support. So you're, as I said, scrounging all the time just to live. You need to be a combat, you need to have some combat infantry skills, which are most important. But you also need the skills of a politician. I mean, you've got to have some interpersonal savvy so that your local, you know, protégés will follow you. I mean, the advisors likened their little isolated outposts where there are 12 Americans and 500 Iraqis to the television show Survivor on steroids, because there were so many yeah. different personalities, and the Iraqis were always angling, that each American had to figure out, you know, how to cultivate his own group so he could eventually lead. I mean, that's the goal in the end. The goal is operational control of the Iraqi unit, or really show them how to act in combat. But they're not going to listen to you in some cases unless they like you. Right. And in all cases, unless you really prove you know what you're doing on the battlefield. So each man has his own personality. I mean, you can't change the, you couldn't change the personalities of the Americans. So it was up to the team leader to figure out, you know, who he matched his men up with.
Mm-hmm.
In one case, the youngest man on the team, who had a freakish gift for speaking Arabic, wanted to go live with the Iraqis. So the team leader allowed this, even though the man was not the best fighter on the team. In another case, the team leader, DEA agent Mike Troster, his deputy couldn't stand the Iraqis, couldn't stand to eat with them, thought they were lazy, didn't like them, you know, openly despised them. He was an active duty Ranger. But Troster used him very effectively. Troster used him as, you know, a demonstration of how you should act on the battlefield, because Roberson was extremely tough. So Troster basically prevented Roberson from interacting too much with the Iraqis, but Roberson went on a lot of patrols and showed them what to do under fire.
I was interested, and I wanted our audience to know, how many patrol – could you describe sort of an average patrol?
Yeah, the average patrol depends on the season. In the hot season, you can only really walk – under your 50 pounds of gear, which, by the way, adds about 10 degrees. So if it's 115 out, your chest feels like it's 125 under your body armor. You can really only walk for about an hour, and this includes the Iraqis. So you'd mix. You'd hop into the vehicles to get cool and hop back out. Most patrols lasted about 3 hours. If you detected a mine or there were incidents, you could sometimes be out for 6 or 7 hours. But the most amazing thing I discovered about this group of Army Reserve advisors was the number of patrols that these individuals went on. Several of the men during a year tour went out on more than 400 patrols. And this is a staggering number. To give you perspective, in conventional infantry units during a year tour, you might go out 2 or 3 times a week and get between 100 and 150 patrols. So these guys were patrolling about 3 times as often as in conventional units, and as a result, their casualty rates were a lot higher.
We got about a minute to go until we take our second break. Can you tell me a little bit about some of the other cast of characters that you ran into over there?
Well, I mean, it's such a rich, wild environment. I mean, to any folks who are still active or thinking about going over to Afghanistan, I really recommend the tour, because it is an adventure from the moment you step foot on the foreign base. I mean, things are so different that you're struggling to adjust to the circumstances, let alone the personalities. So each patrol is almost a puzzle. I mean, you're trying to figure out the insurgency, but you're also trying to figure out how to motivate this wild cast of characters, you know, you're supposed to be advising, whatever that means.
Yeah.
And this is, again, why I think we need to put in some hard code as to how successful advisors have managed to win loyalty of their local troops, because it's not easy.
No. We'll come back after the break. I want to talk more about that. We're talking with Owen West, the author of Snake Eaters, here on Veterans Radio. Give us a call, 877-573-7825.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
We're back on Veterans Radio talking with Owen West, the author of Snake Eaters, about the U.S. advisors in Anbar Province. Owen, was there ever a time with these advisors when they just kind of felt like all was lost?
I think there was. I mean, the advisor team was only 10 men strong, so they were woefully undermanned. Indeed, our advisor teams in Afghanistan are still way too small for the job. So if you can imagine, you'd have a few patrols a day. This meant guys were going out two and three times a day and still had to attend meetings and survive on the Iraqi base, help the Iraqis build fans, etc. So when the advisors started to get wounded, and as I said, the casualty rates are much higher on these small units, which is why in Afghanistan in 2014, we're hearing a lot of things about the United States troops transitioning into a supporting role. People should not be surprised if casualty rates in individual units spike.
Mm-hmm.
In this unit, all but two of the men were wounded and one was killed. I mean, if you had a conventional unit where you had 80% casualties, this would be historic. So once they had
talk about the medic, Blakely. He was such an inspiration not only to the Americans but especially to the Iraqis. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Well, it's typical that the favorite advisor is the medic, because U.S. medicine is a weapon on the battlefield. Mm-hmm. I mean, the insurgents have bullets the same as, the infantry advisors, but they don't have the same kind of medical care and knowledge that the medic carried in his pack. So Doc Blakely, who was a National Guardsman from Indiana, loved the townspeople so much that he was very well known from the outset. He used to hand out candy on almost every trip. He used his own money to buy a diabetic some medicine. He'd have hasty checkups in the middle of a patrol and soon be surrounded by two dozen kids all opening their mouths, and Blakely would check their eyelids, etc. In January of 2006, a sniper targeted him and shot him through the shoulder. This is what's known as turtling, when a sniper tries to hit you between the bottom of your helmet and the top of your armor. So it made the advisors a little nervous that there was a skilled guy out there. Blakely refused to be evacuated from the battlefield. The governor, Mitch Daniels, came to Anbar and presented Blakely his Purple Heart. Blakely refused to talk about it and just put the medal in his sea bag. And in June of 2006, 5 months after he'd been shot, Blakely was again shot in the same area of his body, but this time he was bending over and unfortunately was killed instantly as the bullet struck his heart. All the Iraqis were despondent. When the call went out that Blakely had been hit, the Iraqis unbridled their emotions, as was typical when they had a combat death, and were weeping and screaming and firing their machine guns into the air. Americans tend to brood after we lose one of our own. And most of the guys then eventually plot revenge after ceremonies. The Iraqis just much more emotional immediately. And then they're also much quicker to accept, which was interesting. But no one ever forgot Blakely, and many of the Iraqis wondered why the insurgents, of all the people, had targeted the one guy who was loved by all the townspeople, because not all the advisors or the Iraqi soldiers were loved by all the townspeople.
Mm-hmm.
His killer, we believe, was a 16-year-old boy who was the brother of the most famous sniper in town. The 16-year-old was picked up during a raid about a week later by a mix of SEALs, Iraqi Jundis, and the advisor I mentioned, whose name was Roberson, who was an active-duty ranger. When they captured him, the Jundis wanted to kill the boy on the spot and beat him to death with clubs. And the advisors, whose job it is to act as, you know, often the moral compass on the battlefield, refused, obviously, to let the Jundis execute the boy. And the Jundis warned Roberson that the kid would be out in just a few years. And unfortunately, they were wrong. He was set free in 2 months.
That's a constant story that we've heard when we're talking with veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, is that the, you know, I don't know, it's almost like the military judicial system kind of lets them down, because, you know, we're so concerned about proof and evidence and so on that we can't, you know, we can't treat, you know, those countries like the old West and just string somebody up. And I know, I realize that that's a moral lesson that we're trying to teach the rest of the world, too. But, boy, it must be frustrating.
Yeah, it's crazy to impart these laws on a battlefield. I mean, when I got to Iraq, this was after Mike Troster, the DEA agent, had left. Advisors are like jockeys. You know, you're training the thoroughbred, and you kind of switch places, you know, in mid-race. So I hopped on that thoroughbred, and I was reading through Troster's after actions. Troster had been in law enforcement for 20 years. And in one of his after action write-ups, he said, you know, you will be subjected to ridiculous evidentiary requirements that I don't even see in the United States, let alone in the middle of a war.
Mm-hmm.
We called it catch and release. I mean, the problem was that we don't kill the enemy right now in Afghanistan, and we didn't in Iraq. What we mostly do is arrest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we round people up and arrest them because there are no sustained firefights where you close and then destroy the enemy. What you do is you catch them in the act, or you get information on them and you make an arrest. So if the arrest is replacing the enemy killed in action, we need to make sure that you know, we are not regenerating these folks on the battlefield by letting them free 2 months later. This is still a big problem in Afghanistan, by the way. Their incarceration rates are much lower than they are in Vermont, and we're supposedly in the middle of a war.
I just find the whole thing exasperating, for one thing. And we've got a program coming up, I believe, in June with one of our associates, Colonel Christine Cook, and we're going to be talking to a couple of JAG officers, judge advocate folks who have been prosecutors in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they're going to try to explain to us, you know, that there are rules and laws in war that many of us, you know, don't quite understand. Because we had similar things occur in Vietnam, where you couldn't shoot into a particular area without permission, and, you know, it'd take an hour to get permission, and by the time you did, everybody was gone.
You know, I think what happened was, early in the war, we were blind because we didn't have local forces. As mm-hmm. we mentioned at the outset, this was our major mistake, not to go in with a plan for advisors immediately after the main combat actions, or we shattered the opposing military. But because of Abu Ghraib and the fact that we were blind, we arrested a lot of folks, and people began to look at this as deteriorative, that is, mm-hmm. self-defeating. But the pendulum swung much too far in the other direction. We gave over sovereignty too early. And we gave it over to a corrupt system of judges where JAGs, you know, who you'll speak to in a month, were basically powerless on the one hand because they wanted to see the local courts render verdict,
mm-hmm.
which was wrong. We should have been able to keep people in jail if we were doing the most of the fighting and dying. And, you know, JAGs are trained lawyers. I mean, these are lawyers who are all over the battlefield now, and they're terrified that we're going to repeat another Abu Ghraib. So in my judgment, they just went way, way over the top. Whereas if a cop is killed in New York City, while the prosecutors may get grief over, you know, letting petty thieves go, et cetera, from cops who arrest them, those prosecutors do band together when a cop is killed.
Mm-hmm.
And they go after these kinds of folks where there's a murderer relentlessly. We need to see the same thing in Afghanistan. If a commander really believes that they have a wanted insurgent who's killed multiple Afghans and United States troops, they have to prosecute them, you know, with absolute prejudice. And right now they're still removed and terrified that they're going to be accused of, you know, of overstep.
Well, if I want to approach this one with only 3 minutes to go, what about the higher command? You know, you were talking, and I guess we should come back to that. So you're suggesting, though, that we need to strengthen our advisor corps in, you know, in both all branches of the service so that they're the ones that can really take the message to the locals.
It's a key part of our arsenal, used effectively throughout the 20th century from the Banana Wars to Korea, World War II, there was actually a big advisory program. El Salvador, Colombia recently with the FARC and drug cartels. But that's right. We need to have it as part of our quiver, and it needs to be ready upon entry in one of these failed states. Mm-hmm. I mean, chances are in the next 50 years we will again enter a failed state, however we get in there. But we need to have advisors and a plan for those advisors at the ready. The local forces, in the end, are going to be the key to revealing the insurgency, not the American troops. We can shatter their military, but after that, we've got to go into a support function. And that's painfully what we've learned after this decade of fighting. I mean, this is what Obama is going to do in Afghanistan. He's just following the template that President Bush installed in Iraq. I think it's right. I just think it's much too late.
Yeah, it really is too bad. And, you know, we think about in all of the wars you were mentioning while you were talking, I kept thinking about, you know, winning the hearts and minds. And that's really what you have to do. And it's not that you have to go in there and bribe everybody and throw money around. It's just that you have to get them to trust you, that you know what you're doing, and that if you're willing to go out in front of them and you know, go into the fight with them, then they're more willing to follow you.
Yeah, no, I think you've got it exactly right. When I hear hearts and minds, I think that's right, but we misapply it.
Mm-hmm.
Hearts and minds is about the local troops.
Right.
We want them to be working with us, and then, indeed, after we leave, as is in the case in Iraq, we want them to further our interests, to be blunt. I mean, we've spent a lot of money and a lot of lives, so we want them to have a professional Army Corps that acts in the interests of its own sovereign state, but in the interest of the United States. As for the local population, hearts and minds is misapplied. Really what you're trying to show is that you are going to be the eventual victor on the battlefield, and they better join you. That doesn't mean you treat the locals poorly. You know, on the opposite, you're still trying to convince them that your side is better.
Right.
But you have to be firm. You can't win certainly their hearts. You may be able to win their minds. That is, they understand that they should probably come over the side of the winners.
Yeah.
But the locals will never love Americans.
Right. I got to cut us off now. Oh, well, thank you so very much for being on Veterans Radio. I encourage everybody to go out and get this book, The Snake Eaters. You're going to be much brighter after you're done reading that. So anyway, thank you very much, Owen. We're going to have you back on Veterans Radio, I hope, sometime in the future.
Well, thanks for what you're doing.
Thank you so much. Until next week, you're listening to Veterans Radio, and right now, you are dismissed.
All views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily of Veterans Radio or the station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.